Kartaya Pratibodhitam Bhagavatam Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Gatitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvam Anusantatami Bhagavad Gita Bhagavadvarshinim. Chapter 15. The first verse is not numbered. So if you have, using Swamiji's book here, a lot of books won't have this first verse. A lot of books won't have the first verse. It was added later, and even in Shankara's time, he did not comment on this verse. But as Swamiji says in his commentary, this verse is helpful. It's a helpful verse, and so in later editions, you'll find this verse added. Okay, so we're going to accept this verse and go through it. So just repeat after me. Arjuna uvacha, Arjuna uvacha, prakritim purusham chaiva, prakritim purusham chaiva, kshetram kshetrajnameva cha, kshetram kshetrajnameva cha, etad veditum icchami, etad veditum icchami, jnanam jnayam cha keshava, jnanam jnayam cha keshava. So Arjuna uvacha. After the end of the last chapter, where the jnani, all attitudes of the jnani were being described, and the jnani was also described by Krishna as the one who is most dear to me, the very most dear to me. Very most dear, really, because the jnani, the one who has self-knowledge, knows the identity, the ahankara has transitioned itself, transferred itself from identification with upadis, the body, mind, sense organs, to identifying the I, landing right on the Atma. So if that I lands on the Atma, on the self, which is Brahman, then that self is the same self that the eye of Ishwara were to land on. If Ishwara were to say I, that I is landing upon the same Atma. And that Atma, the self, is really the Ananda Swarupa. It is its very nature is the love or the wholeness that all beings seek. And so usually that love or wholeness or fullness is projected out onto the world, and then I seek that. But once I've recognized or discovered the locus, the very nature of the love itself, then the mind naturally, kind of like a honeybee for a honey, or a moth goes toward the flames, they use these type of examples, the mind naturally goes toward the Ananda Swarupa, naturally goes toward love. All minds go toward love, right? They all go toward wholeness, toward fullness. If you think it's out there, wherever you project it, that's where your mind is going to go. That's where the pravritti will be. And wherever you think it's not, that's where the nivritti will be, where you'll be going away. Oh, towards and away, all based on love. The love's not there, I'm getting out of there. The love's there, I'm going in that direction. So what about when you discover the very source of love as the very nature of the Atma? Then that becomes the very most beloved. Or I would even say the only beloved. It is the only beloved. It's not that you don't love others, but you love others out of that love. You've removed the projection of the love. You've removed the projection. You only can remove a projection really by discovering the source. You know, it's the same in psychology when we talk about projections. You have a projection, somebody raised their eyebrow, and if you're Swamiji, you'll joke like that, somebody raised their eyebrow in a particular way. You know, that just makes you as though you know what they were raising their eyebrow for. You react to the raised eyebrow. You know. But until you've come to the source, really discovered the source of that reaction, you project it onto things that trigger it. They don't belong there at all. You have to discover the source. Once you discover the source, then you go to the source for that particular, to deal with that particular pain, the pain of the raised eyebrow. That's where you have to go. And that's where you discover where that pain is actually located. It's not located on the projection. It's the same with Ananda. We project Ananda, and then we go after it. Even though it's not there, we go after it. And then, of course, the universe doesn't accommodate it because it isn't there. It's an illusion. And so that's why the Ananda seems to drip off the objects. You thought it was there, and then you get to it, and it's not there anymore. Or it lasts there for a little time, and all of a sudden it drips off, and you're just left with the object. So once you discover the source, then the mind, and the source is not away from you, it's your very being, then the mind rotates around that, like a honeybee rotates around. It just loves to be with that. And that is the most dear for you, to you. And so here, when Krishna says that Jnani is the very most dear to me, because the Jnani is myself. Because for the Jnani, the self is the Atma, right? And for Krishna, the self is the Atma. The Atma is the very source of Ananda, of love, and so that is the most dear. So of course, the Jnani is the most dear to me. So that's a beautiful thing to understand. And so, here, Arjuna actually going through all of that understanding, the Jnani, all of the qualities of the Jnani, the nature of the Jnani is the most beloved, and wants to, because Krishna is always saying, the one who knows me, you know? The question is, then what does that mean, to know me? What is involved in that? So that's kind of the basis for this question. So he says, and just one other aside here. The Gita is divided into three sections, or the first three groups of six. The first group of six, we found very clearly, deals with the Tvampada, the meaning of the word you, Tvamasi, you are that. So the first three deals only with the Tvampada. Swamiji put this in an interesting way. He kind of went through all of the first 12 chapters. But one thing he said, the first chapter, which was really a story, sets the context for the dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna. And so he said, you know, this first chapter is about Arjuna's sadness. It creates a terrible situation in which Arjuna is really suffering. And there's no way out of that sadness. And that's really what turns him into a mumukshu. There's no way in this situation for me to be happy, whether I win or whether I lose. There's no way to resolve this situation. Is there any... what is the way out? And then he asks Krishna. And Krishna spends the whole second chapter kind of giving an overview of the whole vision. In the third chapter, he talks about karma yoga. The fourth and fifth chapter, he talks about sannyasa. The fifth chapter about contemplation, meditation. The whole thing is revealing the nature of the self from the standpoint of the jiva. The second six goes into the nature of Ishwara, which we've just finished. From 7 to 12, it's all been Ishwara. And now we're going into the asi, tat tvam asi, the identity between Ishwara and the jiva, and how to gain that knowledge. So this chapter 13 is the beginning of the third section, which deals with the identity between the tvam, the you, and the that. You are that. That's the Mahabhagya. You, the jiva, are Ishwara. So the first three is the jiva, the atma, the knowledge from the standpoint of the tvam, of you. The second six, Ishwara. And the third, the identity between the two. And so we're starting on the third, you know, Shatka. It's called Shatka, group of six. What?
The third group, the last six chapters, is the word that.
That. You are that. So in the Mahavakya, Tat Tvamasi, Okay. That thou art. So this is the asi. You are the identity between you, the jiva, and Ishwara. Like if I were to say, you, the jiva, are Ishwara. You know, you are Ishwara. I have to understand that to even be able to, for you to have any understanding of that, you have to understand what I mean by you, or what the Shastra means by you, and what the Shastra means by Ishwara. If that's not fully understood, then there's no way to come to the identity. You know, so you have to take the jiva, the twampada, twampada means the word twam, you have to take the jiva from the identification of this physical body to the pratyagatma, the innermost self. You have to take Ishwara from the whole Ishwara upadi, the whole manifest knowledge of the maya, the total maya upadi, that is the whole time-space creation on every level of duality. You have to take that to its source as Brahman, to its truth as Brahman. And so once I've done that for the jiva, taking the jiva to Atma, the innermost self, and Ishwara to Brahman, the innermost self, then there's identity. The identity between the Atma, the Atma is Brahman, right? That the Atma, which is you, the conscious being that you are, that Atma is infinite. It is the Atma of the creation. So even if you say Atma is Brahman, it means Atma is infinite. The Atma, the individual Atma, is the infinite self. Another way of saying it, this myself, this conscious being that I am, is the very self of the universe, of Ishwara. That's the Mahavakya. So the Bhagavad Gita is a whole unfoldment of that Mahavakya. Any Mahavakya shows the identity between the jiva and Ishwara. That's what a Mahavakya is. The identity between you, who you are, and who the Lord is. Be able to say, I am Ishwara. Okay? So here, in this verse, Arjuna just asks a question to Krishna. Arjuna uvacha means Arjuna says, prakritim purusham cha. At the second line, he says, etad veditum icchami. I want to know this. Etad means this. Veditum means to know. I want to know. Okay? I want to know this. What? I want to know prakriti and purusha. What is the prakriti? And what is the who is the purusha? What is the prakriti and what is the purusha? Who is the purusha? What do these two terms mean? What is the kshetra? And what is the kshetrajna? What do these two terms mean? What is jnanam and what is jnayam? What do these terms mean? Hey Keshava. Keshava is the name for Krishna. So, here, as Swamiji unfolds this, Krishna, when he answers these questions, this set of three, he doesn't answer it in the order that Arjuna asks. He says, because prakriti and purusha, though we use those terms, they're Sankhya terms also. And so they can be loaded like with Sankhya, the Sankhya philosophy. And so before answering prakriti and purusha, he wants to do more unfoldment. In Sankhya, the prakriti is very close to maya. It's made of sattva, rajas, and tamas. It's what three principles, the three gunas, three principles, sattva, rajas, and tamas. Sattva is the intelligence principle, that which reflects consciousness. Rajas is that's what's responsible for movement and activity. And tamas is responsible for nama rupa. And so we say prakriti is these three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas, in Sama Avasta, all in a state of equilibrium. We say maya, we use prakriti as a synonym for maya. Prakriti is the material cause of the manifest creation, the manifestation of infinite names and forms, has for its source prakriti, what is responsible for nama rupa, for what we call parinama, what we call modification. So what Brahman is non-dual, doesn't have any arms or legs or any voice. It has no second, no parts. And so it can't create because it's changeless. So what is responsible for the manifestation of the whole creation? What all of the parinamas, all of the modifications, we say that is maya, which we also say is, we also have another name for it, prakriti. But for the Sankhyas, prakriti is something real. It's like a real physical material that has its own being and its own existence. And so prakriti for Vedanta, prakriti is maya. Maya means that it has no being of its own. You know, it's satya mitya. Maya is mitya. It has no individual substance of its own, so that you have maya over here and Brahman over here. You say there's only Brahman, and maya is like a mitya attribute of Brahman. It doesn't, you can't put it anywhere else. But because it brings about no change in Brahman, it doesn't qualify. It can't qualify itself. You can't categorize it as a thing. Because it has no other place to be, and yet it can't bring about a change in Brahman. And so it has no, you can't classify it as a thing apart from Brahman. So we say it's mitya. But it has also no other locus, no other place to be. That's maya. But what if you say that maya, that which is responsible for all of the names and forms, is some real physical entity having its own existence? That's how the Sankhyas use this term, prakriti. The rest of this is pretty much the same. Sattva, Rajas, Tamas, responsible for the projection of the universe and all of that. It is there. It's just the order of reality. For them, it is satyam. For us, it is mitya, right? And for them, then, the purushas is the same also. They say purusha, a purusha, is infinite, changeless consciousness, in pure consciousness that is infinite. But they say that there are many purushas. So then you say, well, how can there be many infinite purushas? How would they overlap? For instance, if there's one infinite purusha, it's already infinite. And so how can there be, where's the room for the other one? And then, how can that infinite purusha have a relationship with this other physical prakriti? So there's a lot of problems there, but Sankhya is an ancient system, and those terms are very well known. And so Krishna doesn't deal with them yet. He deals first with these other two terms, kshetram and kshetrajnam. So purusha, can you understand prakriti and purusha? Prakriti is maya for us. Purusha is Ishwar. So for us, purusha, prakriti and purusha are maya and Bhagavan and Ishwar. So now he says, could you explain these two terms? I would like to know. I'd like to know this. What is prakriti and what is purusha? Then he says, I would like to know, what is the kshetram and what is the kshetrajna? Kshetra means, has different meanings. It means a field. A field is the kshetra. So one way you can take it is the field of experience, right? We'll see in the next verse. I won't get into it much because Krishna will be getting into it in the next verse. But take for now, kshetra is the field, what I experience. Kshetrajna is the knower of the field. What is the field? Who is the field? What is the field? And who is the knower of the field? The field really is prakriti. The knower of the field is Parameshwara. Purusha. So prakriti and purusha is really the kshetra and the kshetrajna. So you have the kshetra, the field, and kshetrajna, knower of the field. So what is that? I would like to know. And then he says, and I would like to know, what is jnayam? what is it that is to be known? In this life, what is it that has to be known? What is it that human beings need to know? What is the most important thing to know? What is it that is to be known? In other words, to gain, what he's talking about is moksha. Yeah. What is it exactly that is to be known? And jnanam means, what is the means of knowledge? And here the jnanam means, you know, what, there are means of knowledge, we look at like this. The means of knowledge are what you actually need to know something, like for instance, for pratyaksha, for sense perception, I need my sense organs. To see, I need my eyes. They are pramana. But also what I need to know is the antakarana, is the mind. Because what happens is, the means of knowledge that we use cause a vritti, an antakarana vritti, in my mind. So without the antakarana, without the mind, there is no knowledge that can take place. And so we'll see, starting in, I think, in verse 6, verse 7, it's the famous section. We're going to be going through, a little similar to the end of chapter 12. We're going to be going through several values that this antakarana, that your mind has to have in order for this knowledge, in order for it really to be available for this knowledge. And so here the jnanam is talking about the attitudes that the antakarana, the mind, has to have in order for this knowledge really to be held. Otherwise, really, without some of these values, the mind is too extrovert. It's too engaged in samsara to have any real interest in this knowledge. If it's if the interest in this knowledge for a mind that's very extrovert means my raga dvesha, my likes and dislikes are seriously involved with the world. You know, to the degree that there's lack of vairagya, this knowledge becomes secondary to the objects that are important to me. Sometimes your knowledge can even, you even use your knowledge naturally, not in a negative or manipulative way. It's just that you use your knowledge to help you attain, rather than to help you make some sorrow work for you, rather than for the mind to enjoy the fruits of the knowledge. I'd say like that. And that's a good thing. It's a good thing. It's not a bad thing, you know. But no, I mean, that means that the knowledge is even meaningful for you. But to the degree that the antakarana is extrovert means I want this to be happy and I'm really serious about it. And I really want it to be. I want this to be happy, for me to be happy. That kind of overrides the mumukshutvam. Well, I'm too interested in my...
Yeah, we were getting interested too.
Did its job, but it's really good.
It's a perfect example.
I couldn't talk to it. I couldn't quite get it in the right position in my mouth.
And click around.
I was clicking around, and I thought, okay, I'm going to stop this right now, or else... He'll just stop and let me finish it. Or I will. He's done his job, I'll take it.
So no interest in...
What I'm saying is, there is a maturity that takes place in this knowledge. Let me just go a little bit on this just for a few minutes. We would say like 99.9% of the world is not interested in this. They really are, truly are not. That's why Vedanta is not meant to be popular. It's not popular. And it's not supposed to be popular. It's meant for a few mumukshas that are here and there scattered about. You know, even Swamiji said sometimes as a great Mahatma in India, so that reputation, sometimes he would be speaking to huge crowds that would fill up a big public park and have these big loudspeakers going way down, you could barely see the end of it, that type of thing. He said, but you know, all of the people, those people are there for, you know, like going to church or to see a great, you know, preacher. So they'll come to Swamiji for the blessings and everything. It's part of the culture. And they'll come to be inspired. But there's not necessarily any mumukshutvam there. There is the blessing. They know that it is a blessing to be in the presence of a Mahatma, to get the blessings of the Mahatma. And they have Shraddha, in that there is such a thing as a Mahatma, that there is such a thing as a person who has realized, that has self-knowledge, that is liberated. That's all part of the culture. And so they'll want to always seek the presence of such a man, such a teacher, and even to get his blessings, or even to bring their family, like in Coimbatore, all of the time, you know, the tribals that are in the hills around, they will come and wait for Swamiji to come from the class, so that they'll stand in line and wait just so that they can come and get his blessings and see if he can help the problem that is there. So much part of the culture. It's all Shraddha. And just the glance of a wise person is considered a great blessing. And when he goes to his hometown in Manjikuti, they'll be lined up for a mile down the streets and around the blocks, waiting just to get that blessing, you know, not to get knowledge, but to get grace and blessing and punya and help with what they need. So those people are living a Vedic life, and they have Shraddha in the teacher, not necessarily a mumukshu at all. They just have Shraddha. And they also know, sometimes pundits will jokingly say, but also with some humility, a pundit is a great scholar. There can be pundits who are great scholars of the Upanishads, the Brahma Sutras. They know Sanskrit so well, they know the tradition, and they can teach it. They can teach it well. And they'll say, I can teach you this, but I myself have not understood it. You know, I can teach it to you, though, but don't think that I myself have realized it. You know, I'm a householder. I have a lot of raga dvesha. You know, I have a lot of things I want to accomplish, but still, I can teach you what these commentaries say. They themselves haven't seen it. They haven't probably been taught with it as a pramana, nor have they wanted to. But it's been their interest that... There are a few people, mumukshus, who need to know this. And for them, the Upanishads are for them. And you will find that such people have this, what we call the sadhana chatushtya, this fourfold quality, to some degree. That's the thing to understand. To some degree, they have viveka, means to some degree, meaningful degree. A mumukshu who has these fourfold qualifications has realized, you know, that there is no, it's impossible to really gain what I want to gain as a human being in this world, because I can only gain glimpses. I can't gain anything permanent in the world. It's just how it is. And they see that. They may not totally be living that out, but they've understood it. And to that understanding brings about vairagya. All to a small or great degree, but enough for it to be meaningful, for this teaching to be meaningful. The vairagya is, you know, since everything is finite, it can't give me anything lasting, and so therefore it's not really what I'm looking for. It can't give me the wholeness or the fullness, or the all is well with me-ness that I seek. It's not capable of that. They're all dukkha yonis, means they're all wombs of dukkha. All these experiences will in the end, because they're all finite, will not give me any true freedom. So that is something which is recognized to a certain degree that brings about mumukshutvam, a desire for liberation. So with that desire for liberation, then the antakarana, your mind, naturally is available to go through certain transformations, you know, because your mind is already pulling away from its relationship with the world that it used to have. It's already started that process. That it's pulling away from raga dvesha. It's becoming, gaining vairagya, dispassion, toward your ragas and dveshas. Because you see that they don't fulfill themselves into anything lasting or positive, really. And so your own likes and dislikes, you know, in a way become less desirable to you. You know? And you actually start to look for something, you know, that will actually fulfill you in a way that your likes and dislikes can't do. That leaves you open for change, right? And so Arjuna is saying, what type of a mind is needed in order to gain this which must be known, which is to be known? That's his question. And so we'll see from 7 to 12, we go through a whole list of these qualities that are actually natural, to become natural, are there in a mumukshu and are very natural, are there budding and growing in a mumukshu and are very, very natural to a jnani. And that's, you know, in Swamiji's book, Value of Values, Vamanik Tvamadanti Tvamahimsakshanti Arjavan, go through all of them. In the Value of Values, it's a list of those. He takes each one individually and unfolds it for you so that it can become a value. You know? You're going to have these.
Chapter 13?
The Value of Values is really a list of all of the qualities that are listed here in chapter 13 from chapter 7 on.
From 7 on.
Verse 7, from verse 7, sorry, from verse 7 on. 7, 8, 9, 10, I think. 11.
We need a handout.
Yeah, it's from 7 to 11. A lot of sadhus and brahmacharis will memorize these verses and chant it as part of their sadhana every day. Verse 7 through 11. Right. So we'll be getting into those. In fact, it'd be nice if I... See, I haven't looked that far ahead to see how Swamiji handles it in the Gita Home Study, but in that little book, Value of Values, does anybody have that book?
Yeah.
Good.
Did you finish the full four qualities you got?
I didn't go into the Shema Dhamma Padati. I just really wanted to do these to point out.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
Two is enough.
So what I'm saying is that I was saying that that mumukshutvam is not really there in 99.9% of the people. That space, you know, to kind of assimilate your experience in such a way to see that, you know, everything is nitya, everything is time-bound, and nothing really can make you whole. You know? I mean, you're just trying to add things on to you, you know, stick things on to you to make you whole. It doesn't really work. Mm. You have to discover that if there is such a thing as wholeness, it's something that's got to already be there and has to be discovered. So this is something that is sought by some people. By few. And you find in the maturing process that with the viveka starts with everything is anicca, everything that I experience is time bound. Is there anything that is free from time? I don't know, but I do know that everything I experience is time bound, subject to birth and death. Is there anything other than that? That's the mumukshu's understanding. Mm. the jnani has recognized what is timeless, the nature of the self, as timeless. Not the mumukshu. The mumukshu has half of the equation. The mumukshu has realized and felt, experientially feels, and goes through that transformation based on the recognition of everything as time-bound, that nothing can give me really what I'm yearning for. It's not possible. That's vairagya for the mumukshu. For the jnani, that vairagya is, I don't need anything because I'm whole. I've discovered the wholeness. That the mumukshu has discovered that this cannot make me whole. The jnani has discovered what does make me whole, the nature of the self. And same, the mumukshu tvam, the mumukshu has a desire for liberation, the jnani is liberated. You know? So that's how these qualities go from being partial to fulfilling themselves. You know? What is it? You discover what is nitya, you discover what is wholeness, you discover, you know, what is freedom, freedom from bondage. And then that's so the mumukshutvam converts all of those qualities complete themselves, you know, into what you're actually seeking. So that's what this jnana is. And jnana is, you know, what is it that we as human beings need to know? What needs to be known? What is the truth, you know, that we must know in order to be whole and complete? That's the jnana, okay? So here, so Arjuna says, you know, this is what I want to know. Can you teach me all of these things? So here, Bhagavan starts out. Let's do a little bit of this first. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha. Idam Shariram Kaunteya. Idam Shariram Kaunteya. Kshetram Nitya Vidhiyate. Kshetram Nitya Vidhiyate. Etad yo veti tam prahuhu. Etad yo veti tam prahuhu. Kshetrajna iti tad vidaha. Kshetrajna iti tad vidaha. This is the first verse in that Shankara uses, the first verse. That first verse that we did was the add-on. So here Bhagavan says, Sri Bhagavan Vacha, Idam Shariram Kaunteya, Kshetram Iti Abhidiyate, Etad Yaha Veti Tam Prahuhu Kshetrajnaha Iti Tad Vidaha. He says, remember Kshetram, we'll see more meanings of this Kshetra in a minute, but what he says here is, Bhagavan says, Hey Kaunteya, means son of Kunti. Kunti is his mother. So here we have, you know, matronymics and patronymics. So Kaunteya is Kunti. Kunti is Arjuna's mother. So hey Kaunteya, son of Kunti. Idam shariram. This idam. This sharira. This body. Kshetram iti abhidiyate. It is this body that is called the field, the kshetra. Etad yaha veti tam prahuhu kshetrajnaha iti tad vidaha. He says, he who knows this, the one who knows this, that is called they call that the kshetrajnaha. The one who knows this field, that is this body, tad vidaha. Tad vidaha means those people who know the difference between the two. I'll explain that in a minute. But tedvidha, those who know the two, the kshetra and the kshetrajnaha, they say that the one who is the knower of this, that one is the kshetrajnaha, and this physical body is the kshetra. Okay? So that's the verse. Actually, everything that is experienced is the kshetra, is the field. But we don't identify everything that is experienced as me. And so nobody has to tell us that this is the field of experience. But somebody does have to tell us that this body, you don't have to tell me that the table or the rug or this room is my field of experience, is the kshetra. But you do have to tell me that this body is also the kshetra. And in fact, it will go beyond that. It will go this body and even the sense organs and the mind and all of the emotions and the ahankara, the I notion. All of these things are kshetra, are the kshetra, are the field. And so that does need to be told. Look at it like this. And this is a commentary on this. In this room, who is the kshetra? If I were to ask you, who is the knower? Who is the knower? And, you know, who is the, what is the field of experience here for you? And who is the knower of the field? And you say, well, all of you are the field, my field of experience, and I am the knower of the field. Right? That's what we would say. I am the knower. And we would all say this. Each one of us would say, this is the field of experience, the kshetra, and I am the knower of the kshetra. And so what that means is that this body, mind, sense organs becomes the knower, and everything else becomes the known. And that's the reality that we find ourselves in. So he breaks that immediately. And he says, know that this body is the field, and the knower of this body, you know, is the kshetrajna. So this body is the kshetra, and the kshetrajna, right, is the one who knows this. And so this is really the beginning of one of the most important prakriyas, teaching methodologies that we call drip drisha viveka, right? Because the instant you say this, then I have to go inside, in a sense, of this body, look in terms of my experience and realize that, just like the kshetra, that I would consider to be the kshetra, this body is actually also qualifies for kshetra because it also is known. This body is also known by the same five sense organs that allow this field of experience to be known. In other words, the physical body, the knowability of the physical body is no different, really, than the knowability of this. I know this through my five sense organs. I know this through my five sense organs. As I eliminate one sense organ after another, for instance, if I'm blind, I'm blind to the table and I'm blind to the body. You know, if my ears are deaf, I'm deaf to the music I'm listening to or the outside sounds, but I'm also deaf to this. I wouldn't be able to hear any bodily sounds, let alone any sounds at all. It's the same with all five sense organs. So it's clear that this is a kshetra. It is not clear that this physical body is a kshetra. And so that's why he starts with this. For he says, starting here, this body, idamshid, this very body, you know, is the kshetra. Is called, abhidhiyate means is called the kshetra. Etad yaha veti, he who knows this, etad means this, yaha he who veti, he who knows this, prahuhu, tad vidha, those people who know the difference between the two, they say, this one who knows this, they say that he, Tam, is the kshetrajna, is the knower of the field. Shankara gives a few definitions here, some etymologies of kshetra. One etymology, he says, is kshetatranat. Kshetatrana. Kshetatrana means it's kshetra because it rescues you from kshetra. It rescues you from falling. It means falling into lower upadis. Lower upadis means taking on lower or worse births because it's in this body that you can accrue punya. So you can accrue punya to rescue, to help you from falling into lower yonis, into lower worlds. He says also it's called that the kshetra because kshayat, it's something which goes through, it decays and dies. Same with Kshadanat. It degenerates and decays. Kshetravat is another one. He says it's also called Kshetra because it's like a field. It's like a field because in a field, you have to cultivate the field to grow fruits, you know? And here you have to cultivate your life to grow punya, punya and papa. So you have to take care of the field properly to grow beautiful fruits. If you don't take care of the fruit proper, you know, the field properly, then you can get, you know, not reap things.
Weeds. That are
yeah, weeds. You get weeds. And so he says, you know, it's called a field because it produces karmapala. The way you cultivate the field will produce karmapala, punya and papa. It's kind of interesting etymology. So he says, so this starting here, this body is the kshetra, you know, and I am the knower, the kshetrajna. And so this just begins really the drikdrisha viveka, because once you realize that this physical body, once you start on this path, once you experience and recognize that really this physical body is kshetra, it is experienced by you. That's how it starts. This body is experienced by you. It is known by you. It is known by you through your five sense organs. You know? And then you have to say, yes, but my five sense organs are also kshetra because they also are known. They also are experienced. You know if they're working or not working. And so they are then put into the realm of the kshetra. Then you have to say, but my mind, which knows if my sense organs are functioning or not, that mind also is known, also is experienced, right? And so that mind also goes into the kshetra. Then you can say, even the ahankara, the I thought, is nothing but a thought. It is also known. Even my emotions that are coming and going as a kind of the fruits of my activity, those emotions also are known. My memories are also known. You know, all of my experience, all of these things, that everything about the upadi that I take myself to be, the body, the mind, the sense organs, the moods, the emotions, the memories, the talents, the knowledges that I've accrued, all of these things are kshetra. All of them are known, just like the world external to the body are known. So everything becomes the kshetra. Now when I say that, now everything about me that I've identified with becomes the kshetra, then who really is the kshetrajna? Who is left? Right? When I objectify everything, I realize that everything that makes me me, right, has been now objectified and given over to the kshetra, then who is left? Right? Well, actually, what is interesting is that I am left. The one that I am left. But that one has been differentiated from everything that is objectified. And so, we'll just read this so I can tell you the punchline here. But then we have to do this.
Yeah.
We have to do this next verse next time, okay?
Kshetrajnam
chapi mam vidhi. Kshetrajnam chapi mam vidhi. Sarva kshetreshu bharata. Sarva kshetreshu bharata. Kshetrajna yor jnanam. Kshetra kshetra jnayor jnanam yatta jnanam matam mama yatta jnanam matam mama kshetra jnam cha api mam vidhi sarva kshetreshu bharata kshetra kshetra jnayoho kshetra kshetra jnayoho jnanam yatta jnanam matam mama. He says, this is Bhagavan speaking, he says, may you know kshetranyam cha apimam vidhi. May you know me as the kshetranya. So Krishna speaking, may you know me as the Kshetran. He says, and also, may you know that I am the Kshetranya. I am the knower of all this. And then he says, I am the Kshetranya Sarvabhuteshu. I am the Kshetranya in all beings. I am the one who is the Kshetranya in all beings. So that means, here's this, this is why we have to spend next class on this. This is the Mahavakya. The Kshetranya that is you is the Kshetranya which is in all beings. So the Kshetranya that is left out, after you've objectified all of these, the body, the mind, the sense organs, the me that is left, Bhagavan says, that one that is left, that Kshetranya, is me and is the self in all beings. I am the Kshetranya who is there in all beings. Means I am the conscious Yatma, the conscious being, which is there in all beings. Kshetra Kshetranya Yoho Jnanam, that knowledge, knowing that, he says, the having knowledge of the Kshetra and the Kshetranya, of these two, that really is Jnanam, according to me, he says, in my opinion. But of course, Swamiji says, when Bhagavan has an opinion, it's not really it's not really opinion. Bhagavan's opinion is knowledge. Bhagavan's opinion is means this is how it is. What is really knowledge, what it is that all beings, what it really is to be known, what needs to be known, right, is this. You know, the difference between the Kshetra and the Kshetranya. The Kshetra, like all of this, all of this is the Kshetra. And the Kshetranya is only one. So we can look at, there's an infinite number of things here. Say that infinite number of jivas. It's almost like having an infinite number of mirrors reflecting one sun. So here there's an infinite number of jivas. They're all identified, the Kshetranya, with the body. Or with the body, mind, sense organs. But upon analysis, what is left is only one Kshetranya. Kshetranya. And Bhagavan says, and that Kshetranya is me. So it's like the self of Ishwar is the self in all beings. But the self that I am is yourself. The self that I am is Bhagavan. The self that I am is Bhagavan. Or you can say, Bhagavan's self is me. Some people don't like to say, I am Bhagavan. So they just say, Bhagavan is me. Right? There is no me, there's only Bhagavan. But that Bhagavan is me. See, if you say that, is something that negation is sometimes problematic. Like if you say, there is no me, there is only Bhagavan. That's fine, except when you say, there is no me, then there is no me. That's not even here, that's not something to even discuss. If there is no me, then whoever that is, isn't here. Do you understand? If you say, there is no me, right? Then that me is not something to talk about because it's not here. So what you're really saying is what you had taken to be me, a me, what you had taken to be the self is not the self. Then you're talking about something that is, not something that is not. Right? Because we're only... What is not in your realm of experience. It doesn't exist. So you have to realize what you're saying. You're talking about a mistake. Like if you say, this body is not the Atma. The body, the mind, sense organs is not the Atma. Right? This is not the self. Sense organs is not the self. Body, mind, sense organs complex is not the self. It is anatma. Anatma means not self. Atma means self, anatma, not self. This is not the self. This is not the self. The whole complex is not the self. Vedanta would say, that is true. Or we would say that that is true in the sense that it is mitya. Right? But what you're really saying, this is not the self, this is not the self, this is not the self. Then what if you were to say, and so there is no self? That hasn't been established in what you're saying. What you're saying is, this is not the self, the mind is not the self, the sense organs is not the self, conglomerate is not the self, and so therefore, if you say, and therefore there is no self, no, what you have to say is, and therefore, these things that you had taken to be the self are not true, are not the self. That's what you've established there. You know? And so then you can say, you know, you don't want to label what is there as the self, because this physical body, mind, sense organs, has already ruined that word. You see that? This body, mind, sense organs, this is more Buddhist, body, mind, sense organs complex that has been called the self, mm-hmm. because it's been called the self, they've ruined the word self.
Oh,
you see what I mean? And so we're not, can't use that word anymore. But Vedanta won't look at it that way. Vedanta looks at what actually is the self. What we've made a misattribution of being, of our being, the being that we are. You know, through this anyonya adhyasa, we've taken the being that we are and attributed it to an upadhi, to something which is actually mitya, which is actually not the self. And so we leave what is, but we remove the ajnanam that has caused what is, the me, the conscious, that self-evident being, to become limited by its misappropriation onto the body, mind, sense organs. This is what we call that anyonya adhyasa. It's very interesting. So anyway, he's saying this to me, you know, this understanding between the kshetra and the kshetrajna. It's really the understanding of satya mitya. This is knowledge, he says. This is the knowledge, in my humble opinion. In my opinion, this is what it is, what needs to be known. This is jnayam. He says, this is the knowledge, meaning answering Arjuna's question, though, what is jnayam, what is to be known? This is what is to be known, that's what he says. So we'll look at that, how that unfolds next week. Shape, Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Harihi Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha. Harihi Om.
You know, rather the meditation that we did in the beginning, were to be the knower,
right? To notice that you're not doing anything.
Right. Yes. Exactly. But that is already doing something, isn't it?
No, the mind is doing something. But you can notice, you can differentiate between your own presence and see if, even while your mind is thinking and these things are going on, it's all of that thinking and whatever activity is there is going on in you, in your presence. And your presence simply is. It's not performing any type of an activity. Activity is taking place, but not that you aren't doing anything to make that activity known.
Yeah, there's a persistency of the mind to want to know.
There can be, but that also is illumined.
Yes, it is.
It is, but the luminary isn't doing anything. The luminary isn't saying, "Oh, let me know this," or "Let me know that." All of that type of activity is itself illumined. But you aren't doing, at the bottom line, you aren't doing anything to make that be known, or to make yourself be known. There's no activity there. And if you can notice that, no matter what activity is going on in the mind, whether they be emotions or thought flow or whatever, you are remaining constant. The me remains constant. There's no activity, there's no doing. So we always think of ourselves as doing something, or knowing something, or contributing something for something to be known, and actually, you're not doing anything at all. You're stable. Your being is stable. And it is the knownness which everything enjoys.
So when you're sitting there, you're not experiencing the knower, you're experiencing knownness, right? I mean, is there a distinction between the two?
Well, I use the word known to say, just to try to help make a recognition take place. Like, if I go like this, the painting is known, this intervening space is known, my body is known, my sense organs are known, the thoughts are known, the ahankara is known, the self is known. Where's the knower? There is nothing that's not known. So everything's already known all the way to your core. So the core is self-evident consciousness, which is not doing anything other than just being what it is.
So when I close my eyes and I have a sense of knowingness, that's not the knower, that is
that's
knower.
Brahman.
Okay.
It's Brahman. You are Brahman. The Atma is self-evident. You know, and then the mind is the one that creates this duality between know or known.
Right.
The mind is labeling itself as the conscious being, and the content of the thoughts as the things known, know or known. But actually, know or known take place just in self-evident consciousness. You know, there is no knower. You are not a knower. You're being like, even right now, if you just let the mind focus on your own presence. Nothing, you're not doing anything. Ever. You're always exactly the same in the forefront of all of your experience. Always exactly the same. Nothing doing nothing. And all completely whole. It's not like you're partial or something, or that you're incomplete. You are Brahman.
But
complete.
It's almost like an experience of this knowingness.
I mean, it is an experience. It's experience self-evident.
Self-evident.
There's no experiencer behind it for it to be an experience. That's why we say self-evident. When we use experience, usually we use that word for change, experiences that come and go, that are objectified. Mm-hmm. But you have to be careful that you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak, because the self is self-evident. You are your own. You are an experience, a changeless, non-dual experience, the experience of consciousness, but not a dual experience, experience or experienced. It's just that conscious being is self-evident. And so, say, if you're just sitting, you can't get beyond or away from self-evident being. And that self-evident being is you. It's the very me. The I that is, take the word off the I and just let yourself be there. And nothing is happening to you, ever. And it is whole and complete. When the mind discovers that, then it always has that home base, that changeless wholeness. It's no matter, no matter what is going on, what kind of thoughts or dark nights of the soul you're experiencing, or positive, whatever, you are at the center of it. You're not covered by that. It's like the sun is illumining the rain clouds. The sun is not covered by the rain clouds, right? If you're on the ground looking up at the rain clouds, oh, look, I can't even see the sun. The sun doesn't say that. The sun is the sun. And because of the sun, the rain clouds are illumined. That is your situation. All the experiences, none of them touch you or cover you in any way. You're the conscious being there, because of which all of these things are illumined. So you can't be covered by them. You need that viveka to notice that. And in fact, when you have a sorrowful moment or overwhelm or whatever, it's good to just say, okay, let me just be with this. And then find yourself in it. Say, okay, I'm not covered by this. Where am I then? Just notice. There'll come a time when it doesn't matter what type of thought you have or type of emotion you have. You would probably, if I asked, well, which do you prefer? You can say, well, you know, I'll take the clean house over the dirty house. Or I'll take the quiet mind over the agitated mind. But from my vantage point, there's no change in me. And that is true. But I'd rather not have a broken arm, you know. I'd rather that I didn't have to experience the pain of the broken arm or the depression of the sad mind. Or
the recognition doesn't stay, though.
It does.
I mean, I can have taste of it here and there through the years I've been with you, but it doesn't. Unless I sit down and do my viveka body mind complex.
Yeah. So then, as when you have to sit down and do that, then you sit down and do that. I'm saying, there comes a time, you know, that the mind works out enough of its stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, that you don't have to sit down. You're always in that sitting down space. But you see, even if as the mind is in its very organic and natural process of maturing in the light of this knowledge, you know, it has its own process. Just for you to be able to say, unless I sit down, is a great thing. That means that there's somebody home that can say, that's an advancement. Somebody's home that can say, okay, look, I am totally whacked out and overwhelmed by this, by my mind at this moment. If I want to get out of this, I just have to sit down for a minute and find myself in the whole thing. And that means the buddhi has some strength there.
What would the wise man say if he was whacked out, say, some big time pain. You know.
Probably say like Swamiji. Swamiji says, the mind does really funny things.
But with that sense of knowingness, and then how do you discern that sense of knowingness when you're just frazzled?
If your mind is in a position where it's so frazzled that there's self-forgetfulness there, he actually talks about this in the, you know, in the question answer I have on the homepage of the website. One of those, he really discusses this, but mm-hmm. it's really a beautiful argument. Mm-hmm. The tumultuousness of the mind cannot outlast your knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so when the mind is in a tumultuous state, you just have to be patient, do what you can to bring it home, but eventually it will wear itself out, and then you'll be there with your knowledge. Your buddhi is not going to lose its knowledge because of the manas. It's just the manas can be overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And so if it's so overwhelming that you feel like you've been shipped, you know, out to sea and are kind of being thrown overboard.
Yeah, no hope.
In time, it's time the mind will settle down and your knowledge will win out.
So what do you do? Just hold on? Or
you just hold on and pray to Bhagwan. Mm. Or do what you do. Do inner child work or take a walk or
go surfing.
Or say, you know, or go surfing. That was for Edward.
Yeah, there's some wonderful distraction. You know?
That's a good time for coming.
Yeah, or something, you know. But this too shall pass, you know. Just knowing that this emotional upheaval will pass, that's itself is a big thing, you know. And that your knowledge will hold out, which it does every time you come back from these joy rides, you know. And then there you are.
Well, Swamiji said that the buddhi always wins out.
The buddhi always wins out, yeah. And so that's something nice to know when your mind is overwhelmed. But you know what? The mind does settle down in time. It depends on what you're starting with.
And what do you mean by that, what you're starting with?
What you're starting with, you know.
Those complexes are so big?
They're so big, they take longer to settle down. That's all, you know. Take longer you know the example they use of a big bonfire that you light a little. You have to light a little flame, you know. You got to get it started. Then you have to protect it, you know, to get it started. But eventually, that flame starts growing, and it doesn't really need protection anymore. But then it grows and grows and grows and swallows all of the wood, eventually. You know? And that's, so all of the different complexes and attitudes, you know, we can grow up also with attitudes, value systems that really don't work. They're adharmic. You know, but we were raised with them. Attitudes, ways of being to others, ways of being world, the way our parents were. You know, that create pain. But we're so conditioned to be that way that sometimes we can't see outside of it. Which is one reason why they say it's such a great benefit to have a teacher who has some nishta, you know, who has overcome some of these things, who has nishta. Like, I mean, I feel for all of my time with Swamiji, whatever time I got to have with him, besides gaining this teaching from him, one of the greatest things for me was his, the role model of being with a teacher who is mature. You know, to see how he would handle situations, handle people, handle his own life, some of which was pretty difficult. But do you get to experience somebody being in a way that you would like to be, you know? That's a great thing. They in the tradition also, they always have the students live with their teacher. And that's one of the main reasons, really. It's not just to gain this teaching, but then the way that person is, it becomes a role model for you. And so instead, just to finish this off a little bit, you know, when you're in therapy, for instance, the The therapist becomes, in a way, a role model. And the therapist can do that because they only see you in a very contained space, you know, once or twice a week, and so that they can, their behavior can be such that they can be a positive role model for you, so they can interject you as a, interject you as their mother, as their father, as all of the healing, all of the bad interjects that you may have grown up with. And so the teacher does that also. You know, the teacher becomes an interject, a very healing interject. You know what I mean by those words?
Mm-hmm.
So, that's it.
Interject, like into the psyche, the change, the shifting.
The shifting in the psyche. You know, the psyche heals any negative relationships that you grew up with. Mm-hmm. Using this, the teacher or the therapist, as that positive relationship. It's like you kind of...
That's what Krishna was doing with Arjuna, too.
Probably, yeah.
Because they were friends.
They were good friends, but also, Arjuna had, they were friends, but Arjuna had Shraddha in him as the Lord also. You know, and so that's why he kind of thought, why haven't I asked you this before? Well, because I wasn't a mumukshu, that's why. It didn't occur to me. Now in the middle of the battlefield, it occurs.
Well, Arjuna seemed to have been had a very successful life, even though he was going under these hardships.
Well, he had a successful life, but he had an extraordinarily difficult life, also full of trials and difficult situations, which is classic for an epic like this.
Mm. But before he played dice, he was okay, wasn't he?
No, they had so many problems with the Kauravas and Duryodhana, so many problems. You know, I mean, that's an epic, really. That's the Mahabharata, the Ramayana, Rama, and Sita, and Lakshmana. They all had, from the beginning, they had so many difficulties. So these texts are really to show you this is how to handle these difficulties. These kind of the terrible difficulties that life throws your way. And what I've read all of those. I read them when I was young, even at the ashram. When I was in my 20s. And I was so relieved to read them because the solutions or the way that they would handle the situations were so human. You know, because they had the whole spectrum of emotions. They were real people.
You mean like us?
Yeah, they were real people with a whole gamut of emotions and how you handle all of those feelings. It's not about not having them. It's about how to be with life and how to be with all the emotions that these experiences generate. And, you know, and I mean, we weren't raised in Christianity, we weren't raised that way. You weren't supposed to, those feelings were not supposed to be there, only the positive feelings. And if you have the negative feelings, that you're not supposed to. They're not supposed to be there. And that is such a lie. It's just not real. And so when I was reading these texts, it was just so refreshing to see all the heroes and heroines having the full spectrum of emotion. You know, from love to hate to jealousy to anger to rage to joy to everything. Everything.
Well, they didn't feel flawed over that, to have some...
Now, the Dharma is how you act these things out, how you deal with them. That's Dharma. Hmm. Not whether they're there or not, but how you handle life. That's where the Dharma and Adharma comes in. It's not you shouldn't have these feelings, it's how you handle the feelings that you have. How do you act them out?
Well, the Dharma is towards yourself, then, and how you handle that.
How you handle the life events that include your own emotions.
It's also where you create punya and papa.
So it's not just being a goody two-shoe, you have to be okay to yourself as well.
Yeah, both. But that's Dharma also. Yeah. Dharma's 360 degrees. That's also an important... And so is Adharma, 360 degrees. That means you're included the way you treat yourself. is included. That's so important. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Seems like we would realize that, but we don't. Okay. So like saying, seems like we would realize, each one of us would realize that we're actually here in the room and not just everybody else. People aren't, you know, we're not as aware, so aware of our own presence in so many ways.
A good beginning. Did Veda Vyasa write that verse that Shankar didn't make a commentary on because it wasn't there? Or
no.
Do you know anything about it? I mean, it doesn't matter.
Does it? Don't know.
Yeah.
It's just picked up later sometime.
Yeah. Some pundit probably knows.
Some pundit probably did it.
Kshetra means also just literally field, like a farmer's
like
field.
Like a farmer's field. Yeah, exactly.
Isn't that word close to the same word for warrior? Like
what? Kshetriya is warrior. Kshetriya. This is Kshetra. Okay. And that is Ksha. So it's different.
We need farmers, no more warriors.
We need what?
No, we need farmers, no more warriors.
Oh.
Hmm.